Hey everybody, welcome back to Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host Ryan Krause, here with you once again to pull back the curtain on yet another intriguing case that asks a very important question about the criminal mind, which is this. Can a killer be redeemed? Perhaps more appropriately, we should ask, can a murderer learn the error of his ways through rehabilitation and then subsequently be released into society and live as a peaceful, loving human being? The easy answer is that some people can, while others cannot or do not. If you came home one day and discovered your spouse in bed with your best friend and shot them both in the heat of the moment due to being overwhelmed by betrayal, shock, anger, and so forth, that generally indicates a loss of control or even temporary insanity, but doesn't suggest the work of a sociopath or psychopath. Occurrences like this are especially prevalent in domestic disputes. The participants can often be mentally stable people with no criminal history. So, I think there are numerous circumstances in which a killer could be rehabilitated. On the other hand, if you're dealing with somebody who's a psychopath and has already killed, it's a fact that person will never adopt the empathy necessary to be harmless to others. Could the person possibly refrain from killing? Sure. Is it likely that would happen? No. Without empathy, nothing stops them from killing again. So what the psychopath often does, once he's killed, as he'd been doing before he was exposed as well, is feign empathy. If he wants to get out of trouble, it's especially true. Think of Eric Harris getting caught breaking into a van with Dylan Klebold to steal somebody's electronics before the Columbine shootings. He wrote an apology letter to the man and offered great sincerity about recognizing his wrongdoing and how he was sorry that it happened. Meanwhile, in his own writings, intended for himself, he's in total disbelief that he can't just go take this guy's stuff from his van because the dude was stupid enough to leave it in there. He thinks society should work like that, and that he didn't do anything wrong. He can't believe it. Meanwhile, Dylan Klebold, who was extremely sensitive and angry, but definitely not a psychopath, was scared to death regarding this incident. He was shaking in the presence of the cops, and couldn't bring himself to write the letter to the victim of the van burglary because of his embarrassment. So Eric took control. We're referencing someone who talked his best friend into joining him in a plot he masterminded to blow up his high school and murder everyone running out. That's Eric Harris, a psychopath. Had Dylan Klebold been stopped before the massacre and properly treated for his depression and other issues he'd been hiding, redemption was a possibility. But Eric Harris, if left to roam free in society, was going to kill people. End of story. Without empathy, you have no barometer with which to gauge what an appropriate reaction might be to any one occurrence, or conversely, an action. We offer and withdraw our empathy according to circumstance, which makes that barometer very important for the proper functionality of offering responses. If a friend shows up at your door and says they have nowhere to stay that night, you might offer them the hospitality of sleeping at your place. But if you open the door to see a total stranger who requests to stay the night, your response is different. We could use any number of examples, but the area in which the psychopath becomes dangerous is violence, because they don't need to be triggered in the same manner the rest of us do. Without empathy, a violent act is not morally forbidden or even governed by circumstance. It's just something that happens. The psychopath often extracts reasoning from the equation. They just kill people. We generally call this type of homicide a thrill kill. The murderer does it for fun. There isn't always a motive. It just feels good to do it. And that sounds horrifying. But it's the product of not having that emotional barometer in relation to empathy. Without empathy, the lines blur on perception. if you don't adhere to the social contract, your world becomes much more like animals' experience in the wild. There's no society, no pleasantries. There are no gods here, only alphas. A psychopath's intellect is conducive to seeing life in a context of predator and prey. A male bear has no conscience about killing another male in order to mate with the female he desires. He makes no apologies for it and has no regrets because he's designed without an emotional barometer social creatures like humans have. If you hang your food outside your tent, he might come take it. If you interfere, you might become the food. And there will be no second thoughts or remorse. But the bear behaves this way, meaning lacking empathy in the context of a social contract, because it's imperative to survival. He lives in nature. There are no rules. It's kill or be killed. Eat or starve. That's the mentality the psychopath brings into society. It's Eric Harris thinking, like the bear taking the camper's food, that he can just steal the electronics from the van without consequence, that the guy deserves it for leaving them vulnerable. That lack of empathy matches what animals express out in the wild. This is what Eric believes. If you don't protect what you own at any cost, someone else should be free to take it, even though the van was locked. They broke into it. It's quite antisocial. But what makes the psychopath so scary, even far beyond the intimidation factor the bear brings to the table, is that the psychopath, due to the social contract being in existence, and along with the fact he intends to ignore it, has to deceive. The bear does not pretend. If kept in captivity, they can be tamed, trained, and even show love, but they also sometimes turn on their captors and maul them to death anyway. That's the psychopath, the wild bear being confined to captivity. He has social expectations in relation to his civility far in excess of what was intended by nature. Most of the time, he'll just mimic the things people expect of him to gain their approval and get what he needs. But sometimes, without reason, he just suddenly attacks. And when the bear attacks, we never get the answer to why beyond what he is. The bear is a predator. You can put a silly hat on him and prance him around the circus on one leg while bouncing a ball on his nose, and he might cooperate the whole time. But one day, he might also kill you. That's the psychopath. Most of the time, he pretends for the audience at the circus. He puts on a show to satisfy the social contract. They smile at his charms. But it's also true that he would be willing to kill every one of them. Suddenly, without conscience, without remorse, or even reason. And we won't understand why. That's what happened April 14th, 2013, in Davis, California. Police recovered the bodies of 87-year-old Chip Northup and 76-year-old Claudia Maupin from the couple's home in what is considered a safe community west of Sacramento, best known as home to UC Davis and its 35,000-plus students. Their bedroom was the scene of a gruesome double murder in which the killer had stabbed Chip and Claudia more than 60 times each with a hunting and fishing knife. Chip had 61 wounds, while Claudia suffered 67. But what was not apparent was the motive. Why would anyone want to kill this harmless elderly couple? They were active in the community and supportive of the local college scene. They seemed to be very happy. But sometime during the night of April 13th, leading into the dark early hours of the next day, someone cut the screen on one of their windows, unlocked the window, and entered the residence, at which point he stabbed the sleeping couple to death. there were no signs of a struggle. An argument didn't precede the murders. And nothing was missing. So clearly, this wasn't a robbery gone wrong. With Chip being 87 and Claudia 76, no one could seem to legitimize the notion of a love triangle either. Did they have kids looking to cash in on insurance money? Was there some type of business venture gone wrong? And a partner killed them? No. But when detectives examine a crime scene and notice the victims have been stabbed dozens of times in excess of what would reasonably cause death, they suspect the motive consists of a personal nature. Somebody was enraged, and it boiled over. Yet, that's not what happened here. This is the truth. The bear left the circus, and in his wake was unspeakable carnage. But what we learned is what we always knew, yet wanted to believe we could change. The bear is not like us. He is not equipped with our empathy. He does not ask why. And the tragedy is that we always knew. We could see the truth. He didn't hide it. But a psychopath does. He lurks in the shadows. He deceives. He comes in the night. The bear leaves the circus with a blood-stained mouth for all to see. He's a killer. He has no shame. The only shame is our own for believing he was something else. But the psychopath is in the audience. He's one of us. Yet he strikes like the bear. So while the audience at the circus knows to keep its distance from bears or wild predators, a notion solidified by the tragedy of the trainer being killed right in front of their eyes, the psychopath is still seated right next to them. This killer hides in plain sight. He's one of us. But when the sun goes down and the night is upon us, he kills. And like the bear, he has no empathy or shame. He's simply fulfilling his purpose. The necessity of hiding makes the psychopath far more dangerous than the bear. He has to pretend in order to manipulate the system. And so, by the natural process of always pretending, what does the psychopath see as perfectly normal? Indulging his fantasies, making them reality. And without empathy, it's frightening. Here's an example of how that causes violence to manifest in such people. Take David Bain, for example, the man who was convicted and subsequently acquitted of the Bain family murders in New Zealand. There was a young woman he'd see along his paper route every morning, and he found himself attracted to her. But it's apparent he didn't think she would feel the same way about him. So let's examine what a normal response would be within the conditions of our unspoken social contract. David sees a young woman to whom he's attracted, but doesn't believe she would date him. Here are his options. He can sulk in the misery of that reality and let her date somebody more suitable, or he can change, aka improve himself, and hope she sees value in that to the extent she chooses to date him. Of course, she could even see those changes and still feel that he isn't right for her. That's the deal. Nothing is guaranteed. Civility requires you to do what you can within reason and no more to achieve your goal. But instead of formulating some type of plan to win this person over, David Bain tells his friend about a rape fantasy plot he's thinking of using against her to give him an alibi that says he couldn't have done it. It never crosses his mind to do better or look better to get her attention. He just makes a plan to rape her to get what he wants. Empathy is not considered. It doesn't matter what she wants. Like the bear, David has no shame in doing this. But unlike the bear, he has to hide his true intention in a framework of deception due to the social contract. you can't bring empathy and reason to interactions with predators in the wild. And predators in the wild can't bring empathy and reason to interactions in society. But the psychopath is like a bear in a human costume walking among us. As long as the costume stays on, we remain ignorant and feel safe. Yet, the truth is lurking under the darkness of that veil. Beneath the facade is a killer lusting for blood, one designed without conscience. That's who crawled in the window on April 14th, 2013, and killed this loving couple. So let's examine the day the bodies were found and the investigation to follow. It's Sunday in Davis, California, and Chip and Claudia would normally arrive for church, but never show up on this day. Shortly thereafter, Chip is supposed to play a gig with a local string band, but remains conspicuously absent from the event. Now, Chip and Claudia, who had both been married previously, found each other through the Unitarian Church in their local area. Chip was actually a co-founder of the church, and Claudia felt as though she was at home there, so she sought a man with similar beliefs. Chip was a World War II vet who went on to make a nice living as an attorney, and was known as a social activist to a certain extent as well. He and Claudia enjoyed the youthful, progressive spirit of the little college town where they lived. Davis was considered a safe place. Nobody was prepared for this nightmare. Now, when Chip and Claudia missed church, Chip's daughter Mary, who described Claudia as her best friend, calls her father, in addition to Claudia, but gets no response. It's at this time Chip's son Robert decides it's a good idea to check on them. While they were active people, it's certainly not out of the realm of possibility there was an accident in which one or both was left incapacitated. So Robert and his own son drive over to the couple's condo and knock on the door. Nobody answers. Of course, Robert doesn't know anything is wrong, and has no reason to be overly suspicious. It's still early in the day, and from what he can see, the couple doesn't appear to be home. So he and his son leave the condo. Robert has a key to the home, but he seems to think Chip and Claudia are just simply not around. So entering the place doesn't cross his mind at that time. But the police are going to find this suspicious. If he was concerned enough to go there, it meant he believed there could be something wrong. And if something was wrong, it very likely could have prevented them from responding. Therefore, if there was an accident, like carbon monoxide poisoning, or worse, something intentional, like murder, Robert walked away from the opportunity to learn the truth. He says it looked like nobody was home. If he had just opened the door and confirmed that notion as true or false, the bodies would have been discovered. But he doesn't. So he's willing to take a detour from the day that he had planned. There's enough concern to warrant doing so. But for some reason, without anyone answering the door or the phone, Chip and Claudia are considered to just be away from home at the time. How on earth did he deduce that? They could just as easily be dead inside the house, which, you know, they are. So what is the excuse for this half measure? Why drive to the home with a key and then leave without the answers you came to get, when in fact, you can just open the door and confirm? The police need a good answer to that question. They never get one. Accordingly, Robert and his family are headed straight into a storm for making this odd choice. One would think that given their level of concern in driving over to the condo, they would be curious enough to go inside and put those fears to rest, or confirm them. But they don't. They just leave. Of course, nobody hears from the victims again. So hours later, Claudia's stepdaughter, Laura, visits the condo and rings the doorbell. She, too, gets no answer. But her curiosity takes her to the back of the building, where she sees an open window with the screen cut. She approaches. Laura peers into the open window, unprepared for the carnage she's about to witness. She reports seeing bloodstains everywhere, and realizing, at that point, something was terribly wrong. Laura calls 911, and police are soon on the scene. Inside the condo, in Chip and Claudia's bedroom, the police locate the couple, and it seems as though they were viciously stabbed to death while sleeping. There's no sign of a struggle. Again, each person was stabbed in excess of 60 times with what is later determined to be a hunting and fishing knife. But what's worse, almost inexplicable, is the strange savagery which accompanied each of the mutilations. Both Chip and Claudia, after being stabbed to death, were carved open along the torso to expose their organs, intestines, and so on, as though they underwent some crude type of surgery. Inside the area of Chip's stomach, they discover a fully intact drinking glass, while Claudia's abdomen conceals a cell phone. It's apparent the killer placed them inside the victims, but not why he did. The home is not trashed. Again, there's no sign of a struggle outside of the bedroom either. This doesn't seem to have been a circumstance in which the couple was taken to the bedroom and executed by force. They appear to have been asleep. But again, nothing is missing. It doesn't seem as though any type of burglary occurred. So could it have been a hit? Did somebody pay to have them killed? Surely it's possible. But a hitman would very likely not go to the extreme of inflicting well in excess of 100 stabs. That's not subtle, discreet, or even professional, meaning in the context of a hit. I mean, are you inclined to do more work than that for which you've been paid? If somebody asked you to dig a ditch 6 feet deep, would you make it 12 instead by doing a ton of extra work? The easy answer is no. We're conservative. We don't exert effort beyond what is required to achieve our goals. If you want to impress your boss at work, you don't simply just do more of the same you always do. You don't do more work. You take on more responsibility. So, even if you're a hitman, you have nothing to gain with this overkill of Claudia and Chip that couldn't be accomplished by stabbing them a fraction of the times you actually did. Like somebody working in an office, if you wanted to impress the boss, you'd take assignments with greater responsibility, not do more of the same. Now, looking inside the condo, there's clearly evidence of an intruder. But unfortunately, the police find no evidence suggesting who that intruder might be. There are no fingerprints, no DNA. They can't even find shoe prints on the floor. Now, here's where Robert gets into trouble for his action of not using his key to enter the condo to check on the couple. Police can't find a motive, and the killings appear to have been quite personal, given the number of stab wounds involved. In the absence of being able to deduce why a stranger would break into the home to kill an elderly couple, the cops assume it had to be a disagreement with someone. In such cases, the family is always the first avenue the police will investigate. They begin to formulate a theory that there was no intruder in the condo, so to speak. They believe the cut screen in front of the open window might have been faked, meaning someone entered with a key and then cut the screen to make it appear as though it was the work of a person trying to break in from outside the condo. This happens due to an error on their part in profiling the perpetrator. They're looking at the number of stab wounds and assuming the large number indicates a personal connection attached to emotion. But here's the problem with that method. If the motive isn't apparent, you need to identify a point of misdirection. I mean, consider this. Robert is about to come under fire, as are others in his family. The police utilize intuition to come to such a conclusion. It's not fact. What they need to do is identify misdirection in relation to something factual. They don't know who the killer is, but the killer knows who he is and why he did it. We know he doesn't want anybody else to discover the truth that it was him. So instead of saying it looks personal, the more intelligent, insightful approach to the matter is to identify a place in the narrative where the killer tries to steer the ship into dark waters to keep us from identifying him as captain of this journey. The police are looking at the cut screen and open window, and again, utilizing intuition that tells them it's misdirection intended to conceal the truth that Robert used his key to enter and was involved with the deaths. But there's still no motive. They use intuition to hypothetically put Robert in the home and then committing the murders based upon misdirection also formulated through intuition. I mean, they might as well have a fucking seance while they're at it and just ask the ghosts of the victims who's to blame. It's a really ridiculous strategy. They want the open window and cut screen to be a ruse, a sharp turn in the narrative that says somebody tried to make it appear as though there was a break-in at the condo. But that assertion can't be substantiated whatsoever. If we examine the circumstance at hand, we will find that the real misdirection is in the exact physical location and situation where the killer doesn't want us to look because we'll see what he is and why he did it. Misdirection is intended to avert our eyes from the truth. So in order to see it, we must identify a road sign. Where does the killer want to avert our eyes? Why doesn't he want us looking? Those are the questions we must answer. The perpetrator's MO is hidden within. Literally, in this case. So, what is the misdirection? The drinking glass and the phone in the victim's abdomens. That behavior is inconsistent with every other measure taken by the killer within the home. It has no practical value, and from an evidentiary standpoint, is a road to nowhere. Could it be a message of some kind? Sure. But everything else at the scene is straightforward. Or is it? The screen is cut because he wanted to get inside. The victims are stabbed because he wanted them to die. There's no physical evidence available because he took precautions to avoid being detected. All of that gels. Now, where does the misdirection finally occur here? Where does the killer toss dishonesty, leading to confusion, into the fabric of the narrative? Once the victims are dead, he carves their torsos open. What practical value does that have in terms of motive? They're already dead. The answer is that carving them open after death only serves a purpose in the context of motive if what you wanted to do is explore the inside of their bodies. And if you didn't want the police to know that was your reasoning, then after cutting open the bodies to explore them, how could you misdirect your intention so that the audience will be left confused? You put something inside the victims. You create false purpose. Once you put an object inside each victim, the circumstance appears as though the reason you carved open the victims after death was to insert the objects. That misdirection leaves the viewer wondering the significance of the objects, when in reality, they're just a distraction from the truth of the killer's sadistic intentions. The killer wanted to carve open the bodies and explore them, but knew that would offer motive to an extent he could be identified as a psychopath or sociopath. So, after carving open the bodies and exploring all the gore as part of a thrill kill, which is truly the motive at play, the murderer inserts the phone and drinking glass, thereby making something perfectly sensible seem as though it's inexplicable. But notice the misdirection takes place right after the truth. He wanted to cut open the bodies and play with them. He's a psychopath. That's what he's hiding. If you're Jeffrey Dahmer, at home in your apartment, about to perform some horrific act that's equally sadistic, the misdirection has to come much earlier. You're not trying to fool the cops. You're trying to fool the potential victim you've lured into your home. So, you pay a young man for sex, or so he thinks, at which point he finds out you really want to strangle him and pose his nude body for the purpose of a photography session. Our situation here is much different than that. Our killer is in a situation in which he knows the bodies will be discovered sooner than later. He has to manage to avert the suspicion of police, but not the victims. So the truth the individual who committed the murders of Claudia and Chip desperately doesn't want you to know is that he cut these people open for fun. In order to do such a thing, you have to lack a conscience. With that said, in my mind, that makes it apparent we're dealing with someone suffering a very serious psychological ailment, likely psychopathy. Again, it could be a psychopath or a sociopath. Given that the act is not accompanied by petty crime, such as robbery or ransacking, the psychopath is a more likely choice. When you examine sociopaths, such as the East Area rapist, or even the serial burglar connected to the Blake and China Dickus case I recently covered, you often find that they steal petty items, eat food from the fridge, and take mementos. All that's missing from this crime scene is the victims' lives. And the only misdirection we find is at the point the perpetrator carved the victims open. So what it looks like to me is a pair of random thrill kills committed by a psychopath. The phone and glass have no practical value. They're absent of available purpose. The police, at this point, are trying to uncover some type of underlying motive. They think there was a familial disagreement of which they were not made aware. So they bring Robert in for 8 hours of questioning the first day, and his sons, Tony and Oliver, are subjected to the same. This goes on for several days. During this time, the police also search Robert's home and immediately discover something interesting. He steam cleaned his carpets on the same day Chip and Claudia were found dead. Combined with his decision to not enter the condo to check on the couple, even though he had a key, the cops are now looking in Robert's direction. But it gets worse. When the police learn that Robert's son Oliver is schizophrenic, they begin to consider that might be the reason why the crime was so violent and the motive seemingly not apparent at all. At that point, during the same search, the cops find a drawing made by Robert's other son, Tony, which eerily depicts a man with a knife standing over a bed in which two children are sleeping. So, again, here are the cops using intuition. This drawing doesn't mean anything unless it's somehow connected to the murders. Yet, there is no connection to be found, and the police continue to be suspicious of Tony nonetheless. Supposedly, this escalated to the point of that suspicion transferring to others as well, such as their neighbors. People thought maybe Tony did it. even though he was innocent, people maintained their doubts about him. 3 years later, Tony committed suicide. Given the fact that his brother was schizophrenic and that the real killer had eventually been named, proving Tony innocent, I'd venture to guess his suicide wasn't solely a product of this situation. Undoubtedly, there were underlying issues, and this exacerbated his problems. Now, a couple of months into the case, however, there are no other viable leads. Investigators seem to think the family was involved, and that perhaps Robert covered for one or both of his sons in the process. But that's intuition, or, at best, speculation. It's not truth. What detectives really needed was a break in the case. A helping hand. They got it. About 2 months after the murders took place, and with the police focusing on possibilities regarding Robert and his sons being involved, but unable to prove it, a lead suddenly falls right out of the sky into their laps. A 911 call is placed by a young male who wishes to remain anonymous, but will ultimately be identified as Alvaro. After expressing his desire to stay anonymous, the 911 operator asks him what he's reporting. He says, a double homicide? He goes on to say he wants to remain anonymous because his mom will send him to military school if she finds out about this. So you kind of get the idea already that Alvaro isn't the killer. Well, at least according to him. Someone else is. But Alvaro is just a high school kid, and that might mean our assailant is young, if Alvaro's telling the truth. Now, 17-year-old Alvaro tells the operator he knows everything about the double homicide that happened back in April. And he says his best friend, Daniel Marsh, is the man behind the mask. Daniel Marsh was a 15-year-old high school student who was somewhat well-known in the area where he lived because as a 10-year-old, he was not only credited for saving his dad's life with CPR when the man nearly succumbed to a heart attack, but also received an American Red Cross Heroes Award for the deed. It was a selfless act, the antithesis of what one would normally expect a killer to be. Is it possible that in a 5-year span, Daniel Marsh went from hero to monster? Without knowing any further personal details about him at this time, we do see that he was 10 years old when he received the award, and 15 when allegedly committing the murders, according to his friend Alvaro. In that 5-year span, what remains certain is that he went through puberty. It's where most monsters are made. Once testosterone enters the mix, and desires related to sex and violence arise, the psychopath starts to go off the rails. Antisocial behavior begins to accelerate. Child killers, such as a boy who's 10 years old, are few and far between, but we have endless names of high school kids who gained infamy when they were 15, 16, or 17 by perpetrating mass shootings and other extremely violent crimes. Anyhow, Daniel Marsh lived in a house near the murder scene with his mother. His father, Bill, had just moved in nearby. He wanted to be close to the rest of the family and said the locations were within walking distance of one another. Coincidentally or not, Bill Marsh's next-door neighbors were Chip and Claudia. Soon after he moves in, they end up dead, and his son Daniel is the accused killer. Now, Bill didn't know Chip and Claudia, so when the police went knocking on neighbors' doors to gather information, he had nothing to offer. It's said that he moved out only weeks after moving in, citing an inability to pay the high rent. At this time, he was recovering from back surgery, and it's possible he didn't have his full income and truly couldn't afford it. But the timing is certainly a bit suspicious. 6 weeks after he moves out, his son will be accused of the brutal double murder next door. Strangely enough, a neighbor reported to authorities that Bill Marsh moved out of that house next door only a couple of weeks after the deaths, but it didn't mean anything to the cops at that time. They didn't suspect Bill and had no reason to believe they would eventually get a call naming his 15-year-old son as the killer. So, was Daniel Marsh the real culprit behind this massacre? Or was Alvaro hiding something? Investigators wanted to have a word with Alvaro to find out. What you'll hear is essentially a profile of the type of person who does something like this. That authenticity leads authorities to believe Alvaro's story. But is he lying? Let's take a look. Alvaro interviews with police and tells them Dan Marsh often talked about killing people. He didn't think, however, that it was meant in a literal sense. He thought his friend was messing around, just talking trash. He didn't really want to hurt anyone. Of course. Then Alvaro starts telling them the details of the crime that weren't released to the public. So this is what they realize. Either the kid is telling the truth, or he's the killer. Otherwise, he wouldn't have access to this information. For example, from that interview, quote, "He cut both of them open, and just to see the insides or something. And then he went to the woman, I think, and he wanted to know what an eye looked like. So he tried taking it out with a knife, but he said it was really hard, so he couldn't do it." End quote. This kid is basically a serial killer in training, and Alvaro claims he felt like his own life, or his family's lives, could be in danger. But now that the police have spoken with Alvaro, it's time to talk with Daniel Marsh. And this is where the portrait of what developed between ages 10 and 15 emerges. We see an emotional descent, spurred by a single event. It culminates in murder. So, one local detective and one FBI special agent have a resource officer at Daniel's high school bring him in for an interview. He obliges the request without any hesitation, as though it isn't a big deal. That's when they sit him down and ask what he knows about the double homicide. Daniel tells them all he knows is that, quote, "somebody broke into this old couple's house and stabbed them, killed them," end quote. So he shows up for this interview, calm, relaxed, and seemingly not worried about this interaction. Yet, he's not telling them anything. He's not opening up. He's not confessing. The investigators know that's the type of question and answer session that renders itself worthless. The idea in situations like these is that as the detectives, you want Daniel to open the door to his emotions and let you inside where you can see the truth. Of course, it goes without saying that Daniel isn't just going to walk in and say he's guilty. He obviously wants to remain free. So as a detective, what you do instead is ask questions to which it's perfectly clear he would have the answers, but questions that aren't related to the case. They're about him. The detectives will ask how he grew up, and what situations arose within his family during that time. Hardship, adversity, etc. What they're looking for is his wound. What is Daniel's emotional wound? They want to find the one detail that says, aha, that's what made this kid kill. And when they find it, when they locate that vulnerability, they'll lean on him with it. They'll poke at it. Because deep down, we all truly want to express our emotional pain. What detectives seek to do is make you desperate for catharsis from your problems by divulging the truth. All they need to do is create one moment of weakness by way of trust that says, you can talk to me, you can tell me how it hurts, let's do this, and it will be over. And that can be alluring, despite the consequences of confessing. People do it on a regular basis. they exchanged the heavy burden on their shoulders for metal bars in front of their faces. Yet cops take this route and know it will be successful for one specific reason. It offers instant gratification. And instant gratification is a fundamental element in crime. So, these guys are going to try to get Daniel Marsh to confess by way of exploring his emotional life as he grew up. They'll ask him personal questions instead of details about where he was on the night of the murders or if he has a solid alibi. Without realizing it, he'll be offering a profile that can be matched to the killer. The most important element is that emotional wound I mentioned. The cops want to find, as we would in any story, an inciting incident that triggers what follows. Check out this exchange between the special agent from the FBI and Daniel Marsh. "Daniel, I was that loner kid that, you know, there's always that one outcast." Agent: "Dad and Mom split when you were pretty young?" Daniel: "Yeah." Agent: "Wow. And then Mom basically left. Abandoned you. Or your family?" Daniel: "Yeah, for like 3 or 4 months. Now, if you recall from earlier, I said the age range from 10 years old when Daniel saved his dad with CPR to 15 when he allegedly committed the murders is a span of time in which a boy undergoes the physical and emotional changes related to puberty. Testosterone enters the picture, and there's no turning back. Increased size, greater strength, aggression, sexual desire, emotional suffering. A child's palate is full of vast wonder, curiosity, and enthusiasm despite hardship. A teen enduring those same issues can be angry, violent, suicidal, or even apathetic. So, at 10 years old, Daniel learns his mother has been having an affair with the woman who was previously his kindergarten teacher, and she ends up divorcing Bill. Like many kids, Daniel goes on to say he hates this woman for breaking up his parents, even though it's probably true that there was a lot more going on and that the kindergarten teacher didn't simply destroy the union. But Daniel believed that, and that anger, over the years that followed, required an appropriate outlet. At first, when he's 10, Daniel is overwhelmed by anger in relation to the divorce. But as he ages into his teen years and finds no catharsis for that suffering, he desperately needs some kind of release, so he begins cutting himself. He shows the scars on his forearm to the special agent questioning him. But the cutting didn't work, so he soon graduated to starving himself and wound up in rehab for a month to deal with the fallout of anorexia. Regardless, nothing cured the anger, but we can see the trajectory of his desires. He goes from hating other people to hating himself. Of course, he also starts hurting himself. The starvation, the cutting, those types of things can lead to a suicide attempt. And that happens. Alvaro claims that when they were 14 years old, Daniel talked about suicide quite a bit. And in fact, according to Daniel, he actually attempted suicide on 4 separate occasions. But he didn't die, of course. And that's great, but not for the welfare of others. Look at the process here and connect the dots. He started hating others after the divorce incident, and it didn't work, so he began hating himself. That led to hurting himself to cope. After many cutting sessions, starvation, and suicide attempts, it's apparent that wasn't going to work either. So if you go from hating others to hating yourself, and it fails, what will you do when hurting yourself fails? You'll hurt others. It's the only method he hasn't tried, and it's also the most extreme. So, if you've been starving and cutting yourself, depressed and suicidal, what does that clearly say? You want to feel something. So how would we define that thing you want to feel? It could be best articulated like this. You want to feel alive. And what offers that better than anything else and in the context of instant gratification? Adrenaline. Thrills. But if you're seeking thrills and the trajectory of your behavior says you're going to hurt someone else, then the most likely result of such a cocktail is committing a thrill kill. And what do we find is true about the murders of Claudia and Chip? There's no available motive. So if someone is dead without motive, then the purpose was the killing itself. Notice that Daniel's emotional truth says he killed these people. Only upon realizing his emotional truth do we understand why he employed misdirection. The stab wounds themselves don't necessarily indicate a thrill kill, despite suggesting it's true due to the sheer number of punctures. All we see is passion. But carving open the torso to explore the body speaks to something morbidly curious rather than anger. The same goes for trying to remove an eye. Daniel will later say that he was trying to throw the cops off by placing the cell phone and cup inside the bodies. But take a look at why he used misdirection. If Daniel chose to refrain from placing the items inside the bodies, it wouldn't have changed the investigation one bit. Not at all. Those things bear no significance in the context of guilt. Are they relevant? Yes. Could they have meaning? Sure. But unless they offer fingerprints, DNA, etc., they're worthless. I mean, seriously, did he think the cops would find a cell phone and a drinking glass inside the bodies, then turn to each other and say, "Well, it definitely wasn't a high school student, and certainly not that Daniel Marsh kid." That's ridiculous. So, the truth must be that Daniel's effort to quote-unquote throw the cops off is a physical manifestation of his emotional truth. That's what he's hiding, his emotional truth. That's his real vulnerability. So, of course, what do the cops attack in the interview? Where do they start digging to get to the core of the matter at hand? They get out their shovels and slowly but surely unearth his emotional truth. They go back to where it all started. The divorce, the anger, cutting, anorexia. They see the suffering and understand where the root of his pain is located. What they did not realize, however, is that the misdirection at the crime scene was the physical manifestation of Daniel's desire to conceal his emotional truth. That emotional truth is not only extracted from questioning in the interview room, it's also embedded in the physicality present at the scene of the crime. But the items he chooses are not without symbolic significance. What does Daniel choose to put inside the bodies? Inanimate objects. And what did he say he felt? Dead inside. Daniel cuts open two people to explore what's going on inside them. He feels dead inside and wants to know what's going on inside him. The scene reflects that. The items placed inside them don't belong there. So what do the cops ask? Why? Why are there inanimate things inside the victims that don't belong there? But it isn't a question for them to answer. That's what Daniel desires to know. How did these things get inside him that make him feel like he isn't even alive? That's his true curiosity. Torsos being cut open are a manifestation of that emotional exploration. Now, what do negative emotions cause on a physical level? sensory overload. We hear, taste, see, touch, and smell, which is usually great, unless we're being bombarded with negativity. I mean, there are times in our lives when the phone ringing is scarier than anything else you can possibly imagine. If you're depressed or suffering emotionally in some form or another, your senses can be truly frightening. So what we see at this crime scene is that the items placed inside the bodies have a strong correlation to our senses. It should tell us a lot about what's hurting Daniel on the inside. The drinking glass represents taste, touch, and possibly even smell, as you taste the contents of a drink when it touches your tongue, while it also offers the aroma of the liquid when placed close to your face to consume it. Meanwhile, the phone obviously represents hearing. But guess what's missing? Which sense hasn't been accommodated directly? Sight. Sure, you see a glass when drinking from it, but you don't need to. If you're blind, that certainly isn't going to stop you from putting a glass to your lips and drinking. And you also don't need to see while talking on the phone. It's not required at all. So, eyesight is the missing link here, in terms of the five senses. Accordingly, what does the killer try to do to Claudia? He attempts to cut out one of her eyes. But he stops in the process of doing it. And why? He found it to be too difficult of a task. Look at the psychology present within that action. Cutting out the eyes symbolizes the fact that Daniel doesn't like what he sees when looking at himself. So he wants to change that perspective, but can't steer away from the self-hatred it would require. In that light, he decides to allow the emotional problem to physically manifest as a solution and tries to cut out the eyes to accommodate. But since the emotional change was too difficult, meaning he couldn't see himself in a better light, the manifestation of that desire in physical reality will prove the same. Daniel proves he doesn't have the patience or skills in life to extract this negative image of himself. So that idea manifests in the crime as him not being able to physically remove the eyes from the victims. Anyhow, while Daniel is going through the suicidal phase and experiencing a lot of anger, he does seek help. But it doesn't work. Therapists and other counselors, while they can potentially get through to him on an emotional level, are not able to cure psychopathy. And the reality is bleak. Being a psychopath is basically an emotional equivalent to having an inoperable terminal physical ailment. It is what it is. You just hold out hope that a person becomes a successful control freak instead of a killer. So after Daniel begins telling Alvaro he thinks of suicide, that phase graduates to admitting to his best friend that he wishes certain people were dead. He doesn't explicitly say he wants to murder them, but we can see where this is headed. Soon enough, Daniel tells a school counselor that he's been thinking about killing. This is clearly a great concern, so Daniel is sent to a psychiatric hospital to get help. Unfortunately, as I said before, he's a psychopath, so there's no form of assistance or change that's going to accommodate his needs. In that light, he's released. And he spirals even further downward. Sadly, the result in this case is inevitable. So, Daniel thwarts the prying questions of investigators for several hours, at which point he begins to crack. He tells them that he fantasized about murdering the kindergarten teacher who broke up his mother and father. In fact, he went past that point. He actually plotted to murder her by way of slitting her throat. But again, he was 10 years old, so it was left to fantasy. Of course, guess what the element was that merged with murder to allow fantasy to eventually become reality? Sex. he hit puberty, started producing testosterone, and like most kids reaching their teen years, he became overwhelmed by his newly formed sexual desires. Except, Daniel wasn't like most teens. He developed a fetish for gore porn. That's right. He found himself sexually stimulated by violence. According to Alvaro, one day Daniel showed him a website he frequents that boasts pics and videos of extremely gruesome deaths, such as beheadings, and Daniel seemed unfazed. But that's not uncommon for some of us. Morbid curiosity can be a healthy thing. Just not for a psychopath. This is when Alvaro says things went to the next level. After watching a lot of gore porn, Daniel strangled a cat to death that he captured in the street. Alvaro asked why he did that, and he said he just wanted to. He hated the cat. But here's where we get the truth. The psychopath can't control the urge to kill. Daniel says he held off until, quote, "I couldn't take it anymore. I had to do it. I lost control," end quote. And what's sad, and perhaps more so scary, is that what he did was illegal, immoral, and disgusting. But it was still the truth. He let go and fulfilled his destiny. In his words, quote, "I cut a hole in the screen, climbed in through the back, went to their bedroom door. I opened the door, then I just kind of stood over their bed, watching them sleep for a few minutes. My body was trembling. I was nervous, but excited and exhilarated. I was actually going to do it. I was there. It was finally happening," end quote. And if that isn't chilling, the thought of a psychopath standing over your bed with a sharp knife while you sleep, about to kill you, then I'm not sure what would be. We point the finger at the individual and say he's a bad guy. We denounce his existence and scold him for his choices. But he isn't the bad guy behind the mask. It's nature. Evolution is what sends us this trash. In order for us to not have disdain for the manipulation evolution imposes in the form of suffering, we have to blame the ailment. We do the same thing with diseases. A very popular phrase these days is "fuck cancer," which is obviously a wonderful sentiment, but it's a lot like blaming a child for showing up late to school when his dad was the one driving the car. Yes, he's late, but as a result of the actions of another entity. Cancer is a product of nature. It is not a rogue operative or a flaw. It's an intentional design. Nature sends two things in abundance: miracles and suffering. It never stops. And what is consistent throughout is that if something goes wrong, we blame society. It's the psychopath's fault people get killed. It's the plastic bottles we drink from that give us cancer. The world would be better if only so-and-so was president. We blame nature's design on social ills because we're being manipulated into it. But evolution, aka nature, makes psychopaths so we'll study their brains, and causes cancer so we'll reverse engineer the workings of the body. All of this conflict and suffering is necessary in the process of evolving to find better technological solutions to everything. That narrative finally results in immortality. That's the goal of human evolution, boiled down to a single plight: immortality. And what does immortality through AI offer that we can't have as human beings? Relief from suffering. Nature, or evolution, delivers suffering so that we will get sick of this shit and transcend evolution. My laptop doesn't suffer. My refrigerator doesn't either. Nor does my vehicle. But I do. And that's going to be the tipping point for a paradigm shift where we start playing the game with awareness of the truth rather than in ignorance of it. The things we build are better than that which we've been afforded by nature. That ideology lends itself to an obvious truth. Nature needs to get the hell out of our house and not let the door hit it in the ass on the way out. I'm tired of being depressed. I'm tired of going to funerals or learning of children with inoperable brain tumors. Every new iPhone has a much better camera than the last, but my eyesight sure as hell hasn't improved one bit within that time frame. All of it is just so silly. Here's a great example of the manner in which nature manipulates us. If a new restaurant opens, the owner might tell you that he opened it for many reasons, including a need for that type of cuisine in the area, passion for being a chef, culinary innovation, great service, love of great food, or anything else like that on a surface level that appears to benefit customers. But don't we know the truth is this? People have to make a living. The restaurant was opened to get you to come in and spend your money, thereby allowing the owner and his employees to thrive. That's the type of manipulation that nature, or evolution, has to employ as well. It needs to make you believe the truth about our existence is something other than the design of evolution. The restaurant is designed to turn a profit, but if the owner got on TV in a commercial and even greeted customers at the door by saying, "We just want to make money. We don't really care about you," then the business would begin to fail. The customers would revolt. Same thing goes with evolution. If we don't place blame on societal elements instead of revolting against evolution, then the process of nature fails. As a species, I can't tell you exactly where we come from, nor can I offer anything definitive about our ultimate destination, but I can tell you everything in between. Evolution's design is the truth about how the world works. Society is just a product of evolution's manipulation, a grand attempt to divert attention from its true agenda. Even our entertainment industry is plagued with exact replications of this process. It's astonishing to me that people have the audacity to deny what's blatantly obvious. Here's a great example. Let's go back a few decades to a classic film that's had a few sequels and even been remade, which is The Karate Kid. Ralph Macchio stars as a teen who moves from New Jersey to California and has trouble fitting in at his new school. He gets in a few altercations with local bullies and ends up getting embarrassed with some type of ass-kicking each time. This is when he's noticed by an older man known as Mr. Miyagi, who becomes his mentor in life. Daniel tells Mr. Miyagi he wants to learn karate so that he can defend himself against his foes. So Mr. Miyagi finally agrees, and Daniel expects to learn karate. Now, in this scenario, think of Daniel as society and let Mr. Miyagi be evolution. Ready for his first lesson, Daniel is shocked and surprised to learn that Mr. Miyagi isn't actually going to teach him karate. What happens is that Miyagi starts giving him mindless physical labor in the form of things like manually sanding the back deck at his home and using a paintbrush to stain the entirety of his fence. Daniel goes along with this at first, but after doing much of the work, it soon dawns on him that he's being manipulated into doing Miyagi's household chores and learning nothing about karate in the process. His anger and realization mount, until one day he finally blows up at Mr. Miyagi and says he realizes he's being used and doesn't want to be taken advantage of for the purpose of waxing cars, staining a fence, or sanding a deck. He demands Miyagi cuts the BS and teaches him karate. Miyagi then goes to Daniel and tells him to mimic the motions he utilized during all of that hard work that seemed irrelevant to his plight of learning karate. So Daniel complies. He waxes on, then waxes off, like he did with the cars. He also tries the motion of staining the fence with the paintbrush, in addition to sanding the deck. And that's when Miyagi starts simulating punches into the movements. So Daniel then sees that the movements he learned are for blocking the punches. And the truth suddenly hits Daniel like a ton of bricks. He was learning karate the whole time. Miyagi showed Daniel no empathy and even watched him suffer in ignorance of the truth while the boy's hard work seemed to only benefit Miyagi. That's exactly what evolution does to us in society. It's guiding us toward our goal while making us do its dirty work that doesn't seem to benefit our cause, but truly does. Miyagi performs this operation the same way evolution does as well. He isn't present to hold Daniel's hand. Daniel trains on his own and in his ignorance, while simultaneously striving toward his goals by serving Miyagi's desires. Just like Miyagi offers a reciprocal agreement in which his manipulation will result in Daniel ignorantly accommodating his own desires and Miyagi's through hard work, evolution does the same. By serving evolution, you serve yourself, in the same way that Daniel learned karate by getting manipulated into doing Miyagi's chores. But the thing we absolutely must realize from this film is the following. The day comes when Daniel realizes he's being manipulated, and he refuses to comply until he's been given a satisfactory explanation as to why he's not learning karate. Likewise, that day will come for us, humanity, as a collective unit. We'll drop the paintbrush, look to the sky, and say we know what the hell is happening here. But just like in that movie, when that day comes, we'll have come so far, there will be no turning back. More importantly, we'll be able to see evolution's desires, in the end, are all related to our welfare and not its selfishness. There's no malice. Mr. Miyagi gets his chores done for free, of course, but what he really wants in the end, as nature wants for us, is to see Daniel win. Evolution wants us to survive perpetually, to ascend the evolutionary ladder until we break free and there is only us remaining at the top. Accordingly, how does the Karate Kid end? Daniel wins a karate tournament in which there is literally a bracket displayed that shows him as the last person standing. He wins and is at the top of the heap. And like evolution will do for us, Miyagi stands off to the side, proud and smiling, yet irrelevant in the process now. Daniel doesn't need him to survive anymore. He can handle himself. He can defeat all comers. Daniel has finally grown up. The film ends with that shot of Mr. Miyagi's face. His head is high. He's smiling and proud. And while we know this graying old man was once instrumental in formulating Daniel's future, he knows the young man has reached a level of autonomy that forces him to step aside and permit Daniel to fulfill his destiny. That shot of Mr. Miyagi's face, that freeze frame that ends The Karate Kid, is not just how some ridiculous 1980s teen drama culminates. It isn't just any old film. It's our story. The plight of humanity. The goal. The suffering. Sacrifice. Change. We love stories where people change and live happily ever after, because it's what we want at the end of our own story. Not just for a few decades, but the rest of time. But to get there, we have to face some horrifying adversity. And with replacement of the human brain, or operating system, being integral to our development, we must be saddled with a continuous supply of brains that go way off the rails. You can't fix something that isn't broken or learn about something without dissecting it. And to do that, you need the motivation. So we get Daniel Marsh and others like him as a means of examining our brains and reverse engineering the process. And this is what the 15-year-old tells detectives about the experience of murder. Quote, "I'm not going to lie. It felt amazing." End quote. We learn that Daniel took the knife home with him and hid it with his bloody clothes. He says he kept the knife as a souvenir. Just consider that sentiment, he offers. To him, this is like buying an autographed jersey at a professional sporting event. He continues with, quote, "It was pure happiness and adrenaline and dopamine, just all of it, rushing over me," end quote. Notice his excitement, feeling something that isn't anger. Previously, he claimed he felt dead inside, numb, and wanted to feel alive again. So he tried cutting, but it didn't work. Yet, killing people got his motor running. And here's where we get to the part where it becomes obvious he's a psychopath. Do you know how these murders affected Daniel emotionally in the aftermath? His grades at school improved so much that he was named Student of the Month. That, my friends, is a fucking psychopath. Yet, here's where we see it shine through. Now, I have to admit, I really don't like the idea of minors being interviewed or interrogated by police in the absence of legal representation, because it leads to things like the scenario we're about to witness. The FBI special agent present in the interview likely has significant knowledge about the behavior a psychopath offers, and knows it isn't difficult to get the subject to bury himself in ignorance that imprisons him forever. So, listen to this exchange. And this is the same agent from the last quotes. Agent: "You mentioned that pretty much everybody you meet, you have thoughts about killing them and how you would kill them." Daniel: "Yeah." Agent: "So how would you kill me?" Daniel: "Just a lot of ways. Choking you to death with your tie." Agent: "Okay." Daniel: Beating your face into the mirror until it broke and using the glass to cut your arteries. Gouging your eyes out and just smashing your face into the wall. Nothing personal. Nothing personal. That gets a lot of people's attention because it screams psychopath. What Daniel is really trying to say is that emotion wouldn't lead the way if he killed the agent. Of course, it would be personal. Someone is literally attacking and killing your person. By definition, it's entirely personal to him. But again, what Daniel is attempting to convey is that it would be cold-blooded. He doesn't hate the agent. He's indifferent. But he would still kill him in a heartbeat, like the bear I mentioned earlier. And the reason the agent wants that on video to show in court is because he knows this kid is going to kill again and again until he's incarcerated for life. The agent is delivering the death blow. He already has a confession from Daniel. What he's trying to avoid is a situation where this kid gets out one day and kills again. At 15, it's certainly possible Daniel could be treated as a juvenile, especially if mental health concerns are a factor. But the detective knows this kid is a monster. In fact, prior to that moment, Daniel conveyed to the FBI agent that he had been seeking to take another victim after the double murder. He went around the streets of his neighborhood with a baseball bat at night, hiding in the shadows for the right opportunity to attack a pedestrian. But he never found a suitable situation. In Daniel's own words, quote, "I don't feel sympathy for other people at all. Don't feel empathy for them," end quote. Accordingly, the agent realizes he's dealing with a psychopath. But they're going to need to get this kid in front of a psychiatric professional to make an evaluation. So Daniel meets with him. And what does he proceed to do? He threatens to kill the psychiatrist. But like the cops, the shrink thinks he's sane. Daniel's legal representation goes on to build a defense around his use of a prescribed antidepressant being the cause of temporary insanity leading to the murders. But it's plain as day that he was torturing and killing cats before it was ever prescribed. He plotted to slit his former teacher's throat at age 10. He wasn't taking pills then. So Daniel goes to trial, is found guilty of murder, and receives 52 years to life. 2 years later, however, California passed Prop 57, which requires a juvenile court judge to be the person who makes the decision about whether or not the minor will be tried as a juvenile or adult. The bottom line is that this meant the court would revisit Daniel's case with a real possibility he would be retried in a juvenile court. Of course, he's already confessed and is going to be found guilty again if that happens, but the juvenile court would only be able to hold him until the age of 25. At the time, he was 21 years old, which meant he could be back out in 4 years, or less. Worse, he wouldn't be placed in a halfway house or even supervised by way of parole. He would have no accountability to good behavior after being released for killing two people. So, a hearing is set to decide Daniel's fate, and he takes this opportunity to do a TED Talk. That's right. A video is posted online showing Daniel Marsh in his prison sweatpants talking to the audience about letting go of hatred and anger and embracing our humanity. I mean, it's one of those things you only do if you're a psychopath who can't help himself. He recorded it to prove people can change and that he'd learned his lesson, to the extent he should be given a second chance. But it comes off as totally narcissistic. I would analyze his words in the video, as I was able to find the text of his speech, but there's really not anything to learn aside from what we already know is true. The video itself has since been taken down from YouTube and other providers, but here's the gist of everything he's trying to say. Quote, "I came to realize that there are no such things as evil people in this world, only damaged people," end quote. And that's when he suddenly claims, out of nowhere, that he was sexually abused by two people in his youth, but totally refuses to name them. It's desperate and pathetic. The abuse wasn't just low-hanging fruit. It had fallen from the tree and was rotten to the core. Everybody could see it for what it was. That is, except Daniel's father, Bill Marsh. He was obviously overcome by denial that he used as a coping mechanism. He not only believed the sexual abuse claims, but also believed the antidepressant use had caused his son's psychological problems. Of course, there's no way to legitimize the sexual abuse because Daniel won't name the perpetrators, and there's no way to lend legitimacy to the antidepressant claim due to the fact he admitted to having murderous fantasies before taking them. When faced with that notion regarding the antidepressants, Bill Marsh thought his son misremembered, which is ridiculous. This man was living in denial about who Daniel really was. And why? Because the kid couldn't change. He was a psychopath. In his denial, it's apparent Bill Marsh developed this coping mechanism prior to the murders. It isn't how he dealt with it afterward. That's just who Daniel always was. When we can't change something awful and must live with it, unable to face the truth, we employ denial to cope. Want to know exactly how much denial we're talking about in this scenario? After the conviction, a Dr. Matthew Logan interviewed Daniel with a prominent checklist designed to identify psychopathy. He scored 35.8 out of a possible 40 points, meaning this was one of the higher scores the doctor had ever witnessed. Daniel Marsh even took the stand at his new hearing to speak on his own behalf, reiterating much of what he said in the TED Talk about overcoming his demons. But the psychopath is a pathological liar and a manipulator. It was all bullshit. In the end, Daniel was seen for what he is and ordered to serve his original sentence of 52 years to life in an adult facility. Why? Because of things like this. Of the murders, he said, quote, "It was the most exhilarating, enjoyable feeling I've ever felt," end quote. Daniel Marsh claimed to have roamed the neighborhood the night of the killing and said he scouted or attempted to enter as many as 50 houses before finding the window unlocked at the home of Chip Northup and Claudia Maupin. Yet, the residence just happened to be right next door to his father's new home, and the couple inside was not only elderly, but the man was even more than a decade older than the woman. I think this was definitely a thrill kill, but certainly not a random target. I believe this was a warm-up murder for a future as a serial killer, and he chose this elderly couple, and at a time they'd be asleep, to minimize risk his first time out. But in the end, what really resonates with me is this part of it. Daniel said he cut the window screen like a doggy door and then climbed through the window into the house. He heard the couple snoring and followed the noise to their bedroom, where he found them sound asleep. Yet, he took no action then. He just stood there, looming over their bed, shrouded by darkness, his sharp hunting knife glimmering from the shadows. In their ignorance, Daniel held their lives in his hands. He was God. And perhaps for that single moment, Daniel Marsh was in control for the very first time. It was exhilarating. It was the most enjoyable feeling he ever felt. And then it was over. Gone. Like a dream. He woke up and realized he controlled nothing anymore. As frightening as that is, we're all trying to do the same thing. We want to feel something that delivers us from the horrors occurring in our own minds. So, as you wander aimlessly through the darkness of night in your own life, searching for meaning, peace, and a way to finally feel alive, may you hold on long enough to realize that a new day is perched on the horizon, and with it comes the sun. And as you walk toward its light and warmth, you will never come any closer to arriving in that place no matter how hard you try. But in the process, what will be entirely evident is that if you never stop, your world will always be illuminated with love. And if there is any darkness from which we truly seek to escape, it is that which resides within the secrets buried in our hearts. So march to the beat of its drum. Keep moving toward the light. And never give up. Because we cannot control this life. We're not able to make the rules as we see fit, or even choose how we feel. But if we let go and live as intended, at the end of our story, we're guaranteed to find freedom. And if there's anything worth fighting for in this world, maybe that's it.